This is November 13th, 2006, an interview with Brigadier General Jean Vorono at the University of Victoria, conducted by Titania Gutterson. So to start, when and why did you decide to join the military?
I had, toward the end of my high school years, I had pretty well decided to join the armed forces. But at the time I was looking at the Royal Military College in Saint-Jean, Quebec. And I had an interview and I had visited CMR, as it Collège Militaire Royal, as it was called then. It's no longer in existence, of course. And I had made up my mind I was going to go there. I really didn't have any idea what it would be as. I didn't think it would be Navy, for sure, in the central part of Canada. The Army, particularly in my area, the Army was, and I had had quite a bit of intercourse with the militia in Sorel, the town in Quebec. So anyway, I was getting ready for that. My cousin, older cousin, by about 5 years, Louis Vérin was serving here in Esquimalt. And he wrote me a letter in about 1950, the summer of 50, or before that, spring of 54, I guess, and told me about a naval program that was going to be put into effect in September of 1954. It was called the Venture Plan. And he told me that he thought that this would be a much better avenue, that the Navy was really serious, and he would consider that their plans and methods and etc. were going to be very good, and that I would enjoy the adventure. I had a good, quite a high regard of my cousin, so I took him at his word and made the arrangement for an interview with the Navy in Montreal. And I ended up here in Esquimalt in Victoria in September 1954.
How long did you serve for? How long did you serve for?
37 years.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
And how many years did you fly for?
I guess I flew for from 1955 here at Padbé Airport. Until officially 1974, so about 20 years. I would fly a little bit after that, but I was no longer keeping up with my qualifications.
And what was your training experience like before you entered the aviation program?
As a pilot or?
Before entering the naval aviation, did you have any military training before that?
No, I was quite impressed with the military because I used to be a member of a youth club that organized dances and all kinds of things like this. And the militia were very kind in providing the venue for these parties. And they were very helpful, very kind, very, you know, I was impressed with their demeanor and everything. So that really, I thought they were excellent role models. So that piqued my interest. And I thought that if anybody could achieve this kind of results in training pretty well ordinary people and turn them into such sophisticated ones, then I wanted to be part of that.
Can you describe your training once you, to become a pilot, what your training was like?
Well, I started here in Victoria. The second year of venture was a two-year course of academic and military training. And in the second year of the course, we were interviewed and encouraged, those of us who seemed to show aptitude and physical, made the physical qualification and medical qualifications, were encouraged to go to Centralia in Ontario and take the test. They had a special program to determine what your capabilities for flying as a be a pilot were, and if you passed that, then you could be enrolled in their training program. So I passed that. I was not very sophisticated, you know. I came from a small town, small village in Quebec, and that my coming to Victoria was probably not the first time, but maybe the second time that I crossed the borders of Quebec within Canada. I used to go to the United States with a large contingent of family members in the United States. But east and west, no, not at all. Only once, I think. So I was happy to go for the ride. I really have no expectation for myself, except I was confident that whatever I was able to do, they would be recognized, and if it was good enough, that would be good enough for me. So I really have not thought about the future any more than the next day and the next week and graduation and the year ends and that kind of thing. But I was encouraged to go and take that course, the test, and so I did, and I came back and we were trained on a little Fleet Canuck, a little one-engine, light little Cessna, you know, except with a tail wheel as opposed to a nose wheel. And that was also an aptitude test. We were being tested for our aptitude. And I did very well. I did very well. I don't know what the ranking, but it was an above average graduation test. And then we were sent, at the end of 1956, we were sent via Halifax and all this, I'll spare you the details, we were sent to Pensacola in Florida to take our flying training with the U.S. Navy. And I did about a year in Pensacola and the surrounding areas, including carrier qualifications in the Bay there. And then in Texas, in Kingsville, Texas, for the final advanced jet fighter training. So I was one of, out of 79 or 80 pilots who were sent, Canadian naval pilots, who were sent to the United States. We were only two selected for fighter training, and we both graduated and came back to Canada a year and a half later to Halifax to fly in Banshee, which was our jet fighter then.
Can you describe your what training was like with the U.S. Navy versus the Canadian Navy?
Well, it was the Navy. I think it was an excellent decision on the part of the Navy to use the U.S. Navy as the closest atmosphere and operation and organization for training pilots. Those who could not meet the naval, physical medical requirements of the U.S. Navy were sent to the Air Force. And the training was very good, but the atmosphere in which they practiced their profession from the early point on was not the same. When you're on the Navy base, you're surrounded by naval personnel and ships and carriers and all this thing. It creates an aura and a scene, I guess, that you absorb very early in the program, and you copy, you model yourself on the behavior of all of the people that you see around you, and these people are naval aviators, and their idea, of course, is flying at sea, not flying from a 6,000 long runway, but about a 600 or 700 feet one, and landing taking off at about six times the force of gravity, and landing with about three times the force of gravity, and stopping it within 100 feet of contact with the deck. So I think that this was excellent preparation for a career in the Navy, and as an aviator. So we had a high regard for the U.S. Navy. You know, there hadn't been that long that the Korean War had ended, and the Canadian Navy and the American Navy had worked very closely together during that time. Our NATO role made us, our closest partners were the Americans, and they still are today. And therefore, and they were going to be our bosses, and they were going to provide the wherewithal for the formations of ships at sea. We were not going to be in charge, we were going to be part of the group. And the group was going to be American. So to learn from them and to see their operations was an excellent preparation. It was in a much bigger context than what we would have seen and learned in Canada. So that was excellent. That was outstanding. And from then on, of course, when we operated at sea on exercises, there were always American carriers around, and we took part in the same exercises, and sometimes because of weather we landed on each other's ships, and it made it all very easy because we were very used to it.
Which aircraft did you train in the U.S.?
In the U.S. there were a series of aircraft. It started on a little Mentor, which was a little two-seater, one single-engine aircraft, and then we flew the T-28, which was I don't have any pictures, unfortunately, with me, but it was quite a frisky, not quite a fighter, but very, very close to that. So you really had to be good to, it was a very powerful engine. You could fly at very high altitude because of the special manifold that compressed the air, and so that even though at 20,000, 25,000 feet, the air is very thin, you could still fly it, and that was quite a difficult thing to do. And once you finish that, and I did a lot of the 300 or so hours I flew, I probably flew 250 or so in the T-28. It was a long preparation, all the aerobatics, all the carrier qualifications, all the formation flying, the aircraft flying together, all the gunnery, all the bombing missions were all done in the T-28. Once that was completed, then you went to Kingsville, Texas. Everything else had been done around Pensacola. And then you flew a TV-2, the Navy called it. It's called the T-33 here in Canada. And that was mainly to make you do the transition from propeller, because you have a lot of torque and all kinds of consideration with pedals and when you take off and when you do maneuvers. When you get into a jet, there's no torque. So you have to fly differently. And you're going a lot faster too, so you have to think accordingly. So that was just a transition period. And then it was the F9 F5 Panther, which was a single seat aircraft. So that was the first time, you had flown solo before in all of these aircraft, but they were always equipped to carry an instructor. So you were always under close supervision and while you were doing your tests, whereas with the F9F, you were alone from the word go, and you were judged by how well you accomplish everything in the formation of fighters. So, and I was very lucky because I did all my F9, F5 training as the only student in the group. All the other members of my formation were instructor in training. They were pilots who had flown for a long time, but now were being trained to be instructors. So I was very lucky. I had the best, maybe the most difficult at time, but also the best, the most supportive group of people around me while I was going through that. So it was quite an advantage.
If a typical training day did exist, what did that look like?
Oh my God. Most of the time, until jet training, I would have to get up during the T-28 phase.
Okay.
During the T-28 phase, and that was probably at least 6 months of the year and a half, or more, maybe even more. I think I used to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. We would alternate driving our cars, a group of two or three students. We would drive about an hour from Pensacola to Whiting or to other destination in Florida, even Alabama. And then we would, that was the start of the day, was about 6 o'clock, you see, by the time you got there, or so, maybe even 7. And you were finished at about, it was mostly flying in the morning. Of course, it was very hot, too, you see, and no air conditioning. So they loved to fly us in the morning, and which was a good idea because we work our little bum off during aerobatic and all this stuff. So sweating was part of the game. And so I would be back home probably 4 or 5 o'clock, have dinner, go to bed, and at about 8. So that was, we had, our weekends were our own, but that was it for a year and a half. Now, I managed to get married during that time as I was young and I couldn't take it all.
What year did you earn your final pilot's wings in?
58, I think. June 1958. And I had married, I already had a son who had been born in May, 25th of May. So my wife and I had a special dispensation to remain in the United States until she was fit to travel. Mm-hmm. And so that's why June. I had graduated, in fact, on the 20th of May of that year.
And do you believe that all your training that you went through prepared you for your future career?
I'm sorry?
Do you believe that all the training that you went through prepared you for your future career?
Yeah.
Is everything that you would have to encounter?
Yeah. This was professional. This was not management training. Mm-hmm. You only talk of yourself and you only you were a survivor. You had to be, not you, it's a surviving course. Part of it is a survival course, a real survival course, but the whole thing is. Yeah, I mean, the people were, as I said, we probably started at least five of us in the fighter program, and only two of us survived. And so it, in the sense of nobody got killed, but you had to meet the standard, and you were not given many chances to make up for your deficiencies. So you really had to keep up with the program. In that sense, that was stress management, that taught you stress management, and of course the qualification to be an aggressive, fearless fighter pilot. Venture had provided me with some of the management skills that I would need later on, but joining a squadron and acting as one of the officers in the squadron prepared me for my career. Anything before that really had been the individual training. Everything after that was team effort, you know. And the Navy was probably, the Navy and the Army provide the best condition for management training. The Air Force, unfortunately, as most of the Air Force, they only have pilots in their units. They don't have maintenance people, they don't have supply, they don't have any men. They only have officers. And now, as part of the crew of some aircraft, they have like the Neptune and Comox and things like this. They do have some intercourse with the ranks and management responsibilities and men management responsibilities, but it's very superficial because the bulk of the Air Force other ranks work in the central maintenance or operation somewhere on the base, and that's it. Well, in the Navy, when you go to sea as a squadron, you go to sea with your entire support operation. All the men, all the, and the pilots, of course. And as a naval officer, you are put in charge of a group of men for administrative purposes. So if they need training, if they need qualifications, certain qualifications, you are the one that's reviewing their records and making sure that when the time comes for them to be selected, that they are given the opportunity to do that. If they get in trouble, you are the one who go and defend them in the trial, summary trial that is held by the commanding officer. And so you get a very, very heavy dose of men management. You have to be one of the maybe operation officer, administration officer, the armament officer, whatever. And all of these are sections that contain a group of men of all ranks, from chief petty officer down to seaman, ordinary seaman. So that's where you get your training, your really team training, because the whole thing is part of the team. So that's how I got a heavy dose of that. And the Army does the same thing, because they work as regiments, and the officers and the men share the same danger and the same, lived in the same condition. The Air Force, the battle is 100 miles in front, and everybody else is relatively safe in the base, back at the base. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah. What type of training did you have to do to keep your flying current throughout the year?
We have a monthly, quarterly, and yearly qualification that we must meet. For weapons training, and for instrument flying, for all weather, flying at night, flying in the clouds, etc. So you have to keep, and you are tested in with somebody at the back that is keeping track of all your faults and all your little mistakes. So you have to do that. That, of course, you also have to be satisfied the various flight leaders who lead you into battle, and you know if you're the defensive strength of a formation of aircraft is that everybody stays together. If you open a hole because you have strayed from the formation, then you've opened a hole for somebody to come and shoot you. And the visual responsibility for the formation is shared by all the members of the formation. Of course, you cannot be looking to your right if there's an aircraft on your left and you're only 5 feet away from it and you're going 400 miles an hour and you're maneuvering. So somebody has to be looking over your aircraft and anything there, and somebody has to warn you. So this is the defensive, the eyes and the positioning of aircraft provides the defensive strength of the formation. And if you are not reporting a target and it's suddenly upon you, then the flight leader may want you to have it. So this is how you're tested. You're continuously, you never fly, well, you fly alone, but it's for getting from one place to another. You may fly alone, but in combat, you don't fly alone. You wouldn't survive very long if you did.
After finishing your pilot's training, where were you first stationed?
At Shearwater, Halifax, Dartmouth, specifically Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. And I went there in July 1958 for the first time, and I was there until 62. And that was the sum total of my fighter pilot flying in the Navy. So 4 years. I was then sent to Montreal for a desk job, which was recruiting other people. And I did that for 2 years. And I was also, during that time, I was also the secretary of the board for the selection of future, selection of cadets, if you will. And that was done in Centralia, although Centralia was a naval Air Force base, it was also a selection base for the Air Force. And the Navy had determined that their selection procedures and tests and the whole creation of the obstacles that you had to, they were kind of puzzles. You had to go over certain obstacles, or you had to finish a task, and in turn you had to be the leader of a group of young men, and you had to decide. You were not given much information, and we're just the cadet is the people are selected for future officer training on the basis of how well they do. There are other tests. There are like IQ tests and math tests and all this. The test lasts about 4 days, 4 or 5 days, if I remember well. So this is not a fly-by-night thing. It is very demanding. It is very demanding. And at the end of the week, on the Friday, the results have been compiled, and each cadet appears in front of the board and is then made aware of the results of his success in completing the test, and also has given maybe some a chance to explain maybe why something may not have gone as well. Because they're all stranger to each other, and some come from different social strata and things like this. So, but this is the final, and the decision of the board is final. And I was the secretary of that board, and I was that for 3 years, I guess. And during the rest of the year, that was done in the summer for about 2 months, two months maybe. The rest of the year I was traveling to all the schools and colleges in Quebec and Eastern Ontario and giving the pitch, join the Navy and see the world. And I did that for 2 years.
And after that, what was your other posting?
I went back to Shearwater. And by then the Navy had decided to buy the Sea King, and that was in 1964, and I had been selected to transfer. The Banshees had disappeared from the Navy anyway by then, and so it had a choice between flying the Tracker aircraft, that was an anti-submarine fixed-wing two-engine aircraft, or flying helicopters, which were destined to operate from destroyers, and we still had the carrier, so we had a sizable group of helicopters, those helicopters on the Bonaventure. So I had to transition from fighter now to anti-submarine, so under the surface type of warfare, looking for submarines and that kind of thing. So there was a long, strictly academic course of anti-submarine warfare, where you learn about the various layers, the temperature gradients and the salinity and all this, and the effect that it has on sound and what you can expect and that type of thing. Do you learn about all the tactics of a submarine and how they position themselves for attacks and things like that. So we're talking about like a salmon fishing. You have to know where the salmon is going to congregate. If you don't fish there, you're not going to catch a salmon. Particularly if they're on the run, they're not going to stop for a little fly. But when they are at the bottom of a fall or something like this, or behind a rock resting a little bit, that's when they may grab your hook. So that took from September 64 to 65, just doing that, undergoing ASW training. Then there was the transition to helicopters, and that was a lengthy process too, starting with the small Bell helicopter and gradually moving up toward the end, the Sea King itself. And of course, as you progress, it again became less of a flying helicopter and more utilizing the platform to good effect, just like we have done with fighters. So. And that took from August to November. And in November, I was full-fledged helicopter pilot, co-pilot by then, because I was not yet qualified to be the crew commander of the aircraft. And I joined the anti-submarine squadron 50 in Shearwater. And I was to be with them from 65 to July 68.
Can you describe some of what your role was as an anti-submarine pilot?
Yes. We had, we were not as well equipped as the Sea King is today. Our only search system was the sonar. And our only weapon was the torpedo. So the idea was to lower the sonar. It was the Sea King was a excellent platform for sonar operation. Of course, the sonar, unlike a ship, which carries its sonar, which is like a radar, but it's a sound system as opposed to electronic beam that is bounced on a target and comes back and gives you azimuth and range. A sonar is sound that goes and hits a target, and it can be a whale, or it can be a submarine, or it can be a rock, and comes back, and that gives you an azimuth and range. And then if it's moving, then of course that azimuth within the range will keep shifting. So a ship is moving while it's doing a search with its sonar, and there's a lot of cavitation along the hull of a ship. With the helicopter stands still, and all the noise of and the vibration of the rotor is attenuated within the first few feet of ocean. Salt water is a very dense medium. And then not only that, but the sonar could go down to, I'm going to say 400 feet. I don't know if I'm wrong. It's been a long time. But I thought you could go. And remember what I said about those layers of salinity, temperature, thing. They form, like the atmosphere over us, they form a cold and warm front, and that cold air goes over warm air. Well, the same thing happens in the ocean. The warmer water is less dense, the cold water, and therefore. So if you can get below that layer, you will see everything within that layer. If you have to go through that layer, then the beam is going to be sharply deflected, and you will get false information. The range, the azimuth may be right, but the range will not be, because you don't know really what happened to the signal while it was traveling through those layers. So the Seeking was an excellent platform for that, because it was computerized, and therefore, and that's difficult for a pilot to admit, just like the pilot of a 767 today, you know, very often even the landing is done on autopilot today, and it was a lot safer than the visual. The pilot, of course, if there's a problem, can override and then use his brain to analyze the situation. The computer can only, computers were not as sophisticated as those we use today, so troubleshooting within the computer was very, nearly non-existent. But when everything works well, and you're in the middle of the night, and you're standing 40 feet above the sea, it's pitch dark. I mean, you may see down and see the waves, the foam of the, but that's about it. So if you were trying to, imagine people trying to do that before the Seeking, when everything had to be flown manually, and it was a very, very difficult. And it was never well done. It was, terribly done, but that's the best they could do, so they tried to do their best. With the Seeking, there was no excuse. It could do it. It could do the job. And with the nuclear submarine, the Seeking was the most threatening weapon system against a nuclear submarine. The speed of the Seeking compared to previous helicopters made it so that you could track a nuclear submarine going at 40 knots, and you could jump, not alone. You could jump and keep contact on it. I have had contact on nuclear submarine that are maneuvering, very fast in 5 hours. Yeah, so in 5 hours we would have killed it if we had been given the opportunity. And the way we did that was to operate in three helicopters in a triangle. And you always kept the submarine in the center of the triangle. So as soon as the submarine was about to cross the line, then you move the triangle, you move that leg of the triangle. So here we are, he's crossing here, so this helicopter will not jump here and reestablish the triangle. These two will keep track of the submarine, and they will tell the third one that is now transiting to the next position where to go and do the transition and where to put the sonar now. So if everything was going well, we had an incredible weapon system. And this was very, very good naval decision to go that way. And we still have the Bonaventure, so we could sustain that. We could sustain with, I think we had 12 helicopters on the Bonaventure. So when you did sustained operation, 24 hours a day, and you just kept replacing those helicopters on station, you could do that from the Bonaventure. So that was, those were the most, to me, they certainly were the most productive years, and probably we were at the apex of our anti-submarine capability then as the Royal Canadian Navy, and we were much in demand. We were looked upon by all the other navies as master of our trade, because we had always made it a point to be an anti-submarine navy, primarily. The Banshee was there to protect the fleet, and you needed that before the weapons like the rockets and the missiles that the frigates now have. But it was just a secondary player. The trackers and the helicopters were the things that the Russians feared most, not our Banshees. So I enjoyed that part of it. Then when we transferred that capability to the destroyer, we lost a lot of capability, because now you had one helicopter on one ship, so it had to come back to the ship to refuel. Now you could refuel while the helicopter was still in the air. You just picked up the hose and plugged it in, so you didn't have to land. So if the conditions were dicey, and you could fly a couple of missions with the same crew, but you had to leave station while you were doing that. And the Bonaventure, the three helicopters would not leave until the new three had arrived, being positioned properly. And of course, one thing that for your understanding, also, the helicopters, when they were tracking the submarine, had trackers and Argus, Air Force Argus, flying overhead over them and being directed toward the submarine too. So you had a multi-level capability that existed, good contact, good tracking, and then incredible firepower. Of course, those trackers could do the tracking with buoys that they would drop in the ocean, but the range and the capability of that operation was not anything close to meeting what the sonar could do. When you went to a destroyer, you lost a lot of those capabilities. And when we lost the Bonaventure, we were out of the game. Now, it's lucky for us that the Russians capitulated, and they were the only submarine force that really could have annihilated North America. So once you don't have to contend with that, then the anti-submarine role is not very important anymore. And so now our fleet is mainly provide a blockade in the Asia. And in any case, for me, that 1968 was the end of my time in the Navy, and I never went back. So I was there when it was the most productive and the most fun. And from that I learned a lesson, that really shaped the rest of my career. So what happened is that we, naval aviators, were very much in demand. The Army was creating its helicopter force. In fact, it has been said that the death of the Bonaventure and naval aviation was gave rise to the Army aviation program. And before that, they had little helicopters for scouting with the tanks, and they had little airplanes that would direct the fire of the artillery. They would go up in the air behind, and they could observe, and they would watch where the rounds were falling, and they would correct the fire of the artillery. But that's it. And flying in the Army was not a career. And therefore they had not developed the kind of leadership and knowledge, professional knowledge of running an aviation that they needed to expand. And they expanded very quickly. They went from, as I say, maybe 10, 12 aircraft to 300 at one time. So I guess what the Army did is that they selected people that they wanted to come to them to help them create their aviation. And I didn't realize that. But all I learned, I found out, knew was that I had been selected to go to the Army Staff College in Kingston, Ontario. It was called Foxhole U. And there were always a couple of naval officers on the course, but it was, and a few more Air Force officers, but it was an Army Staff College where captains, mainly captains, some majors, went there for a two-year course at the beginning to learn to run a brigade or a division, and a division. And it was excellent training, not naval training, nothing to do with that. So when I went there, I didn't know why I was going there, but I did. So I got my introduction to the Army. Now I was in the Army, Mr. John.
What did it feel like to have switched completely from Navy to Army?
Strange. The good thing is that one thing I guess I had not mentioned is that when I was flying fighters, we were giving Army air support to the Army. And of course Gagetown is not very far, so I trained with the Army. We had our own Army staff in Shearwater that did all the liaison between Shearwater and Gagetown, and we provided the air power, and we did some, that's more mainly where we drop our real bombs and our real rockets. When we were training around Shearwater, we were training with small little bombs that wouldn't have hurt much because they didn't explode, you just little puff of smoke, so you could identify where your bomb had dropped in relation to the target. So we had worked with Young, and we were very, we had an excellent rapport. I had been on the ground in Gagetown on exercises with them and directing the fighters coming for the attacks and things like this, and providing the communication between the Army and the aircraft in the air. So I had some, not, but I was there as a naval officer. I was not expected to know much about what they were doing, but at least there was a rapport. And the Army thought very highly of us because the Air Force had not kept their bargain that they would provide the capability to support the army. The Air Force never bought any aircraft or weapons or anything to do anything to support the army. So it wasn't bad, of course, because they never went after Korea. They never went to war where they would need such support. But it was bad for army training because they were deprived of that capability and the use of that weapon. So the fact that the Navy was prepared, and we were so close to them that we could do that at little cost, because we were coming back to Shearwater to land and refuel and all this, so they didn't have to provide any logistics for our support, was very much appreciated. So when I went to Army Staff College, we were well received. The Army had high praise for, and when they knew all about me, you know. When they had read my biography, I guess they had realized that I had some knowledge of Army tactics and things like this, and we did spotting for the artillery too, just like a little aircraft, but we did it from much higher and much faster. We could move much faster. So we had done all this in Gateshawn and then in Shiloh, Manitoba, for all those years that I served in the Banshee. So when I went to Kingston, we were well received. They would joke at the Air Force, you know, but and they didn't have, they knew that we were men manager, and the Army is very much, well, I don't know if you've been following pronouncements and announcements of General Hillier with Afghanistan and all this, but you can tell when an Army officer is in charge and when an Air Force officer is in charge. The focus is very different. So from that point of view, we were well received, but it was a tough grind. Here you are, you know, with no ground experience, and you are with these young, keen Army officers whose career depends on doing well Staff College. If you don't do well at Staff College, it's the same thing as you fail university, you know. So, they expected a lot for you, because from the team effort again, you were expected to carry your load for the exercises, for the appreciations, writing the appreciation, doing the ground surveys and the location of where you would put your troops on the ground for preparation for battle. A lot of that was done on the map. You probably have seen some of those lines. So it was a tough run, and I worked long, long hours. I felt I was back in Pensacola, you know, getting going to bed late this time and getting up early. But I was determined that I wasn't going to let that. I was not there for the ride. I was going to do my part, and I did, and I did very well, and I can tell looking back. So after Staff College, the course, we were in the first year where the course was 1 year. They had decided that because of the educational level of their new officers, they did not need as much academic writing essays and you know, that type of thing as they had when their officer came really from a level of high school. But so they decided that 1 year was enough. And after that year, I went to work for the Army, and I was with the Army for. Pretty well from 1968 when I went to Staff College until I left Egypt in September 1977. So it was 11 years. By then, I was an army officer. I'm going to take another little break too. So I went I was posted to Army headquarters in Saint-Hubert, Quebec. And I was in the training division of the Army. So they wanted, in their training division, we prepared the big exercises, Army exercises. And that was prepared. Those exercises took place mainly within a concentrated period of time in the summer, in Gagetown primarily, and it meant that everything had to the nth degree had to be scheduled. The arrival and departure of troops, the convoys of supplies, primarily ammunition, all this, and it had come from all over Canada, even the United States, just on time delivery. And of course, you also had to plan the air exercises, the air support exercises as part of that. So that was my primary focus, was the air side. Now, as I mentioned to you, the Army was building up. They hadn't received their helicopters yet, but they were building up for that. So they and the and the Air Force formation that was supporting the Army by then was 10 tanks for their group, and they had their headquarters side by side with the Army headquarters, and they were flying CF. Oh, is that incredible?
It'll come to you.
Yeah. Oh, what? Oh, but not very much. Anyway, they were starting to do the planning for the acceptance, the arrival, and the creation of new units, and the arrival of the helicopters. So I did a lot of this liaison with the Air Force, and as is common in the Army, if you work for them, then they expect your loyalty. And rightly or wrongly, they'll take your word for it more than the word of the other guy who doesn't work, who works for them but doesn't work under them. And so it was a bit of a difficult time, if you will, as 10 Tactical Air Group was, I'm still trying to think, oh, it's not incredible. All I can think is the F-15, but the F-15 came up much later, but I don't have it listed here. Need me, I'll email you. In any case, so I did that for, I was at NARA headquarters from 69 to 70. And I happened to meet them, some officers that were to drag me along for the rest of my time in the Army anyway. And this was probably, I was probably very lucky to be introduced to these people, to work for them at that time, and to get them to get to know me. And as a result of that, my promotions came. In the 11 years that I was in the Army, I went from being a lieutenant commander in the Navy to being a brigadier general in 1977, so at by the age of 41, I guess. I left home in 1936. So professionally, that was a very good time for me. And the fact that I had that SAF college preparation was a godsend. It really made me very productive. Other aviation, Air Force officers, by then I was an Air Force officer. Other Air Force officers who came did not have that grounding that I had been given in Staff College, Army Staff College, and therefore they were suffering. They were really fish out of water when they were posted to some of these shops. So it was easy to shine, you know. And it explains why I progressed so rapidly. My promotion to Lieutenant Colonel was announced in May, I think, or June maybe of 1970, and I was selected to go and take helicopter training with the Army. That was given in Petawawa. So I was promoted Lieutenant Colonel in June of 70, and I went to Petawawa in September 70. And I had only been in Petawawa a month, and you know what happened, October 1970, the October crisis, the FLQ crisis. So all of us were alerted the night before the Army was going to invade Quebec, and we, in the middle of the night, we were all transported. We took all our helicopters and moved to Montreal to St. Hubert Airport. And I had been selected to join the provincial police headquarters in Montreal to provide them with aviation advice, because they were going to use helicopters a lot to do their search, transport their officers and the Army officers. So for 2 weeks, I think, I was in the headquarters 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, sleeping right never left the place, and I was planning all these exercises and attending all the briefings, and it was an eye opener, because you had these special police units, you know, that today they call riots group. Teams and all this, but in those days they were just special operations, and my God, they were scary. I don't know, they were to the bad guys, but they certainly were to the people who were uninitiated. And so it was excellent training. And then when this part of it was over, and they needed more control in St. Hubert, the operation called it, and I was sent back to St. Hubert, and at least I could go home every night. And we flew a lot of operations, and it was a busy and day and night. And that lasted, the October crisis lasted for until December, I think. I'm not sure I have. I have that here. I don't put a date, but I think it was December, when of course the body of the minister was found, and the British diplomat was released, and all that, and then we went back to Petawawa. finish our training. And once our training was finished, I was sent to Valkarachi to prepare labor ground for the unit that was going to be created there, create the space for operation and maintenance of the helicopters, prepare all the crews for their role, and it was a busy time. And my wife joined me the following summer, I think the summer of 71, after our kids had finished school in St. Hubert. And I operated the squadron, which was a helicopter squadron made of two types of a helicopter. Fortunately, I've got the names here. UE, CH-135 UE-2, and the CH-136 Kiowa. The Kiowa was a reconnaissance helicopter. The UE was a medium transport helicopter. And we were going to, and we did, develop all the tactics and all the methods to do air mobile operations like they did in Vietnam. And that's we've seen the films probably, and that's what we were doing, transporting a large number of troops and putting them quickly on the ground and in the most favorable position. And so that was very productive, and I was at the squadron until June 74, and January 74. And then I was promoted colonel. See what I mean? It's coming fast. So, and I was going to go to Saint-Jean, Quebec, as the base commander. It was a bit of an emergency thing. The base commander had become incapacitated, and so in the middle of the year, they just yanked me out, promoted me, and sent me to Saint-Jean. And I was there only for about a year and a half, January 74 to August 75. The main job of Saint-Jean was to train recruits, and they were from all this branch of the service, because all unified then, men and women joining, and to train mechanics for the Army and electronics technician for the Army, mainly. The Air Force was doing its own training around Centralia and places like that, Trenton. And so we were mainly training Army trades and all the recruits, francophone recruits in Saint-Jean. So we were giving them language training, and because Saint-Jean was also the language training center of the armed forces. So anybody who took French language training came to the language school in Saint-Jean. So recruits, language training, and technical training for the Army was our job. Somebody in their wisdom had determined that they were going to create a new base, and the concept of the base was going to change. It was more, you've seen, at least in movies, probably bases where you have all these buildings and lots of land so they can sprawl all over. Particularly if you've seen an army base, I mean, we're talking square miles of territory. Saint-Jean, on the other hand, was in the middle of, well, not on the edge of a city, and it really didn't have very much room, so they went 5-6 story high, and huge conglomerate of that included everything in one block. And this was a very, very difficult concept for the armed forces to accept, but it was being pushed on them by the bureaucracy, the civilian bureaucracy of DND, of the National Defense, the Department of National Defense, because it was the only way to provide the additional training capability that was required for Francophones, for language, for everything, and so it had to be. So it was a very interesting, this, of course, now you're talking with architects and construction engineers and all this, and then you're trying to educate them to the requirements of the jobs, and it was a very, I enjoyed it, the experience that it gave me, and of course we were subject to derision and criticism from everywhere I went, you know. I can't remember now if there was a term for this, which was not a very nice thing, you know. So, but I only, the army called me back. I had just fulfilled their need. They were responsible for that base, so that's why it had to be one of theirs, if you will. Although I was not army, I was Air Force, but they had enough confidence in me, I guess, that they knew that I could be plucked from where I was and go there and not miss a beat, I guess. So as soon as things were settled and the plans were approved and all this, then I was recalled to Army headquarters. And there I was given a very unusual job for an Air Force officer. I was going to become the Director of Combat Development for the Army. So it was a shock. And again, because I'm a good theoretician, I probably, they knew what they were doing. I didn't know my capability, but they knew what I could do. Because I hadn't done these things, so they were picking me up to do these things because they felt that I was going to succeed. So I, in 1 year, we went from a concept to a manning to an organization, an operation of writing all the doctrine for the Army. And doctrine manuals are how formation operate, how they live in the field, how they move, and how they fight, and how they coordinate their action with all the elements, the armor, the artillery, the infantry, and the engineers, the communications. Everything has to move with them, so bridge has to be built just hours before the troops, because if they are built days before, they'll be destroyed. So that's the kind of, so everything has to be put down in writing, and everybody reads from the same Bible, and that's the way even people who are not artillery learn about how the artillery operates and what their requirements are for mobility and resupply, and you know, tons of ammunition. You're talking about an artillery barrage. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. So anyway, we did that all within a year, and I was there this time from 75 to 77. But August 75 to March 77. And even during that time, 6 months of that time, my boss, who was the Chief of Staff Operation, the Brigadier General, Loomis, was selected to do a special study for the Army. This is, again, everything was changing. The Russians had not given up yet, but there were signs that you know, peacekeeping was going to become a role for the Army, for Canada, and he was selected to go and do a special study, and he selected me to be his replacement. I mean, he had all kinds of Army colonels, there, but I was selected to be the acting chief of staff operation. And that gave me a very good preparation for future time of operating with now the center of command, the commanders, and the high-level staff officers in the Army. So I enjoyed that. It was good education. And then to thank me for all that, they sent me to Egypt for 6 months. And I was in Egypt as the deputy commander of all the Canadians and that was serving in the UN and Ismailia and on the Suez Canal. The Canadian role in Egypt was supply. We were not providing soldiers, infantry or anything like that. We were providing the vehicle repair facilities, the warehousing and transportation of goods and material and people. The keeping up of the roads open in the desert, because of course you drive through the desert one day on a paved road and the next day there's sand right up to your eyeballs. So you have to plow those roads just like you do snow, but it's a lot more difficult. So all these things, and the Suez Canal, of course, we were on one side of the Suez Canal in Egypt, but all the operation was in the Sinai Desert. That's where all the troops, because on one side was the Egyptian army that had just been defeated by the Israeli, and on the other side was the Israeli who were not giving us, not giving them any chance to do that to them again. So it was very interesting working with the Americans. Americans had a listening post in the desert. They could hear a fly. Oh, it was just incredible operation. Yeah, they just had their sensors all over the desert, and they were providing all the surveillance, if you will, that would guarantee that the peace was going to be respected by both sides. And it was interesting. This is survival a little bit, because it's the desert is a very, very unforgiving piece of land. And I had the benefit of being able, because I was deputy commander of the contingent of the Canadians, so I visited all the units, the Swedes, the Norwegian, the Nigerians, and visited all these people, and being entertained and briefed, and to find out if we were doing our job on their behalf correctly, and if there was anything we could do to help. So it was I loved to meet all these people and get to know them better and their customs. The other thing, of course, was the living in the desert. I mean, it's survival. And to get a good night's sleep, I'm telling you, you have to prepare a long time for your sleeping quarters to be cool, because it gets hot, very hot during the day, 105, 110. You perspire, but you never see your perspiration. It evaporates before you can see it. So you drink copious amount of liquids, and you pace yourself, and it was very interesting. We had a lot of women in our contingent, and it was difficult for them. For the facilities were not So we have to modernize. We have taken an Air Force base, Egyptian base, and we spend a lot of time and all the labor. We had to provide all our own labor. We couldn't hire. It would not have been secure to hire any Egyptian forces. Now we have people, a lot of people in providing our services that were Egyptian, and wonderful people. But the construction and all this, anything technical, we had to do ourselves to make sure that it was not going to be bugged and things like that. Which meant that all of us had to give some time to labor. And I helped construct space between our... We built a swimming pool. That was done before I arrived. But the space between our dining room and all this and the swimming pool was just open. Now you've seen these little things that the Egyptian hold in their hand, a little stick with the kind of hair of you sit in on that patio, and from the moment you sit until you go inside, you're going to be doing that to shoot flies away. I mean, the flies are just by the millions. So we couldn't live outside. So we were always crammed inside for our meals and all this. And I thought that we had a beautiful patio, which we could only enclose it in I can think only of French terms, screen it in. And between the pool, then it was opening. It would change our life. You cannot imagine how debilitating it is to go out and have flies on your nose, your eyes, you know, everywhere where there can be some evaporation. So they get their fluid. It is incredibly. And so as I see you forever going, it's mainly on your face because you're pretty well covered for the rest. So we did that for the 6 months I was there. It didn't take 6 months, but we worked every time. So that's your spare time. In your spare time, you go and do things to improve your life and the lifestyle. And it was difficult to, because of the conditions of crossing the borders. We could cross the borders very easily, but it was we alone could go across borders. So all our supplies had to be brought by ourselves, and so you have to plan long in advance for what you needed. And before I had arrived, we were often running out of things, and people were really tired of having to make do because, you know, we weren't planning ahead. So I made a special study of what was required, how quantities required so from the statistics that we had. The other problem we had, of course, is all our supply, not only for ourselves, but the whole UN contingent came by sea in the Alexandria. So the ships are there, so the customs had to clear customs, all the stuff had to clear customs. You had to pay back sheesh, which is bribes. So, you know, you had to control that so that it didn't get out of hand. So, but bribing in those countries is a way of life. You just don't do it, but you learn to not overdo it. And that's the key, not overdoing it, and so that they will slow your the process of your foods, and they can do that so easily. See, you're at their mercy. Until they clear the material, you have no say. It's just like, well, you know, what it is to go to customer. But at least there's it's reasonably fast. There it's not. It can take weeks to clear a ship. So always that to be taken into account. And so that was a good time. And would you know it, I had not, before I had left Ismailia, I was a brigadier general. So that was I remember the only communication we had then was short wave radio, and we had people in Canada, an amateur radio operator, could capture our signal, and then they would put the signal on the telephone to our wives anywhere in Canada. So to get to my wife at a certain time, I had to get up, I think it was at 4 o'clock in the morning, and it was just dinner time. In fact, she had just left. We had spent 2 weeks together in Israel. For the 6 months that I served in Egypt, I was allowed 2 weeks of vacation, UN vacation, nothing to do with my vacation time in the armed forces. So some people were taking it in small amount, but I couldn't do that as a deputy commander. Our commander was traveling all the time to all the places. I was a bit of a scout, but he was the guy who had to go and intercede with the UN command and the troops that we were supporting, because he had the responsibility, the rank, and all that. So he was away a lot of time. So I was there to run the base, and I had to be there when he was away. But I could arrange my 2 weeks while in a period where he would be at the base, and that's why I concentrated on my vacation time for that. We had a wonderful, we did the entire circle of Israel and, well, occupied territory by the Israeli. And so TBS, Jerusalem, Bethlehem, you know, all these things. We spent about 3 days in each central location, and went to Eilat, went to the fort there in the desert where all the Jews were killed themselves and committed suicide against the Roman army. I shouldn't remember the name, but I can. So it was a good time with a lot of responsibility, because we shared responsibility. The Polish, there was a Polish contingent, I forgot to tell you. We the Canadians did the supply and the maintenance. The Polish did the transport. So we had to, that was one of the very, my main, when my boss was doing the liaison at a high level, I was the guy who spoke to the Polish commander all the time for the transport. We had a very good relationship. There was no problem. I felt sorry for them because they suffered. We didn't suffer, you know. We managed after a time to make our condition of life very, 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 very good. But their government was, they were mistreated. Just incredible. So we did everything we could. We invited them come to our pool and our dining room and all this. But they rarely accepted. When they were desperate enough, then they would come, but otherwise they wouldn't. Because they had people watching them all the time. They had the commissars watching them all the time. You could never speak frankly. Never, never. You had to be very careful what you said to them. You didn't want to appear to compromise them or to, you know. So it was good training and diplomacy, and I felt sorry for them. I really did. I know they looked at us and they could see that we were much, much better taken care of than they were. So at the end of my term there, it was September 77, I came back to Canada. Somebody had already taken over my job in Army Headquarters, Combat Development. I was sent to Winnipeg to become, this is the first time since I had joined the Armed Forces that I was going to work for the Air Force. So that was the, how are we doing for time?
So good.
So this was my introduction to the Air Force. I had been picked, I know that, by the Air Force to be promoted and to go to Winnipeg Air Command Headquarters to become their Chief of Staff Operations. There was a Chief of Staff Administration and a Chief of Staff Operation. Above that there was a Deputy Commander, Major General, and above that there was a Commander, a Lieutenant General. So I was third level in the hierarchy. And the command had just been recently been created. When the unification took place, they decided that the Air Force would consist of Air Defense Command. That was in North Bay, and they would take care of the Russian bombers and things like that. The Army would get its own aviation, and the Navy would keep its own aviations, and air transport command. So between the fighters and the transport planes in Trenton and places like that, that was the Air Force. So there would have been an Air Force, an Army aviation, and a Naval aviation. Shortly before that, and maybe a year, or two before that, the government, the Ministry of National Defense, and the CDS were convinced by the Air Force that the Air Force should take over all aviation. And so Army aviation would come under the Air Force. They would be under the operational control of the Army, but all the training, they would be Air Force personnel. Same in Halifax with Naval Aviation. So when I went to Air Command, that had started, but they were still in the process of the changeover of control for the Army and the Naval Operation. That's probably one of the reasons why I was selected to be Chief of Staff Operations, because I had served in both. So I had contacts and I could facilitate the process. So, and it was a difficult time for me, because we were adding a layer of bureaucracy and with no increase in efficiency. We were just creating a telephone exchange, additional telephone exchange. I certainly facilitated the process, and it was done smoothly. It was going against the grain now, a little bit for me. So I did that. From 77 to 79, then in 79 I was selected to go back to St. Hubert, but this time as the commander of 10th Tactical Airmen, the group that was providing Army support to the Army. The Army Air Support. And I was just one or two of the commanders that had created that organization. So it was still in the process of development. And obviously, the Army wanted me to go back there to make it because now it was going the other way. So, So I was caught in the crossfire in many of these awful things. And I was in Tintac from 79 to 81. And I presided over the first full Army divisional and Air Force tactical control exercise. It was the first time in the history of Canada that this had been done, and it was a huge exercise. I was not physically in charge because this the doctrine called for a colonel to head all the helicopters. So that colonel was reporting to me for the helicopters in Geisham, but the people who were providing the CF-5 support to the Army were in Air Force Base in New Brunswick. Anyway, I can't think of it now. So I was doing all that from it was mainly a logistic for us, providing, making sure that the fuel was arriving in time and gauge down and things like that. The Army was providing all the nutrition and all these things. But it was the biggest exercise, and it went well. It went very well. And also during that time, politically, in 1979. Prime Minister Joe Clark's government was, and I can't think of the actual timing, but it was defeated. And prior to that defeat, Alan McKinnon was the Minister of National Defense, and he had created a study group to study the effects of unification. Here we were, a little more than 10 years after unification, and he wanted to, the pressure was building. As you know, we all went to a green uniform, and pressure was building on the Navy and the Air Force to go back to their colors and all kinds of things like that. And so he created a group to study all the issues. And their report came due after Prime Minister Joe Clark was defeated and Mr. Trudeau had come back out of retirement to become the Prime Minister. And now Mr. Gilles Lamontagne was the Minister of National Defense. So unification, as you know, politically speaking, no. Unification was the creation of a liberal government, and particularly the Minister of National Defense, Elliott. I'm not even going to go beyond that. And the conservative report had been written with the object of scrutinizing what had been the creation of the previous liberal government. So when the report came back, it was given to a liberal cabinet. So the liberals, the Minister of National Defense, Mr. Lamontagne, wanted a group of officers to review the 30 recommendations that the group had made, prepared for ostensibly a conservative government, and to see what was practical, possible, feasible. So I found out that I had been selected as one of the three members of that group. The Major General Vance was the head of the the committee or the study group, and I was the Air Force member. Commodore Hudson Pillar was the Navy member. So, and I was commander 10 times. So I left St. Hubert and established my residence in Ottawa for 3 months while we poured through all the reports, the recommendation, consulted with commanders and staff and all these, and prepared. It was an appreciation, that we did, and made our recommendation to the CDS all within 3 months. So we worked 7 days a week, and it was and not only that, but I was also responsible for all the military editing of the French version of this report. And in the past, it was so common for these studies to come out. The English report was ready, and the French report was still under consideration and criticism, because it's difficult for a civilian there is a French military language, which, as you know, in France, French, with l'Académie Française, everything has to be perfect. So, and it, unlike English, that the naval term and all this in Britain have become part of the history, that part of the fabric of the nation, particularly the Navy, but even the Army too, because of Wellington and all this. This is not necessarily the case in France. So I had to, and we had to do a lot of rewriting and all this, and so it was a bit of a imposition. In any case, at the end of that, we presented our report, and the government accepted all our recommendations. And the only thing that was left in the air was the question of uniforms. And I won't tell you which way although if you read the report, I dealt with all the unification symbols, all the physical things of unification, uniforms, patches for the regiments, the ranks, lance appellation, and my colleagues were dealing, the Hudson Pillar was dealing mainly with training, unified training, and General Vance was dealing mainly with the units and plus, directing and controlling what we were trying to see. Fortunately, when I had first gone to Army Headquarters, I was working for Lieutenant Colonel Vance, so we had a long association. So the fact was that between the three of us, and it's probably the CES was very surprised that we were able to pull that off in 3 months. These people had taken over a year and a half to write the report and come with these things, and we had to rehash everything they had done and said, and say to the government, this is reasonable, or here's the way we can do it. This is the recommendation, but when you translate that into an army, Air Force, Navy operation, this is how it would be done. So anyway, there was no tension. We did our job. We did it fast, but we were glad it was over. But the issue of uniform was not solved until about a year later, I think. In a different group was named to take care of that. So in August 81, I was done my job as Commander 10 TAG, and I was sent to Washington as the air attaché. And I was also quasi-naval attaché, because naval aviation, being an Air Force functions in Canada, was a Navy function in the United States. I was also quasi-army attaché, because for the same reason, I was the guy who visited army aviation bases and institutions. So I was air attaché, quasi, partially French attaché, army attaché, and partially naval attaché. So from a professional point of view, it was incredible because I visited all of the army institutions and secrets and even a lot of saw a lot of the equipment that the Americans had captured from the Russians. And those days was totally secret because what they were doing, they were using the Russian equipment and pitting their units and aircraft against it, you see, so they could tell exactly how to work around them. And they were using their MiGs to fight against their, that was incredible time professionally for me. And I was there for 81 to 84, so 3 years. I guess I have to say it because you will notice that I was never promoted after that. And you notice that I was exiled. So I was not fitting. The Air Force didn't have confidence in me. And that's all right. That's their privilege. They are entitled to select the people that they feel will do the best job for them. So it took me a little while to accept that but the fact is that I was never deprived of substantial work. I was not put in a position where I could influence Air Force decisions. But I was in a position where, let me rephrase. I was never in a position where I could decide, I could make a decision. But I was always in a position where I had incredible influence. So professionally, I was satisfied. And in a sense, it was easier for me not to be torn more than necessary between what I considered to be the right way of doing things and what my superior were expecting from me. So, it was all right. And then I was brought back to first time to Indonesia. I had never served in Allah before that, but I was brought back. And I served there for 4 years, from 84 to 88. So I was the longest serving Director General there, Doctrine and Operation. It was normally a two-year job, but they kept me at it for 4 years. And my bosses, the Major General for whom I work, insisted that they wanted me. So, I had lots of recognition, and it was a good place to be professionally. The conflict were alleviated tremendously because I could speak my mind to my bosses, and they could translate that. I had already given them all the options anyway. They could translate that into the cause that the Air Force would accept. So, but I remember when my replacement in 1988 came in, he said, "I don't know how you could have survived 4 years. It was a bitch of a job." This was the time when Mr. Mulroney was singing When the Irish Eyes Are Smiling with the president. Another lapse of memory. Reagan and the Minister of National, the Minister of the Secretary of Defense was Reagan. And Reagan, that's where I had. And promising all kinds of good things. The armed forces were going to expand again, that the good days were, and we were going to be the ally that we had been in the Second World War and in Korea and all these things. The budgets were going to increase and we were going to buy the, we had bought the CF-18, but we were going to buy all kinds of other things, the new helicopter, which we haven't, just think. I was working on that project in 1988, and it's not even in operation now. So, but it was soul destroying because the budgets were not where the mouths were. Mm-hmm. We were not going to do any of that. In fact, we were going to continue going down. Mm-hmm. It's called a peace dividend. People said, hey, we don't need to keep standing armies, or at least the size and complexity of the main enemy is gone. It's been decapitated, and the USSR will never, in fact, be integrated as quickly as possible to some of those nations into NATO to make sure that this would, now we could defend these nations and against Sony. So this was the worst time of my life. That was, it had started before that, because I, anyway, but that was so destroying. You go and brief those ministers and they thank you, and I remember one Christmas leave where practically the whole of my staff was working. And the kids, their kids, because the wife had to go and do the shopping, and so the kids were playing in the aisle there, and while their fathers were working at their desk. Yeah. And we would present our plans, and they would turn it down on the slightest pretext. It was so transparent that it was an insult. They were insulting us. So anyway, I felt that I had done the best I could, and I was not going to work after I retired, because I liked the lobbyist and the organization that I was working with even less than I liked the government I was working for. So I was sick and tired of those totally depraved people that I was working with who were only in it for the money and not for the good of the country. So I wanted out. So they wanted to send me to Paris, but I would not mind it. But my wife spoke French. She, Doreen, took courses at Laval and the language school in Saint-Jean when I was base commander, but not enough to do a credible job with the French forces. So they named me Director General of Military Review for 2 years. I was the second person to do that job. And it was supposed to be kind of a board of inquiry, a standing board of inquiry. If anything happened that was of such magnitude that it affected the national interest, that is, headquarters, the government. Then the CDF wanted to be able to send people to investigate the situation quickly, just a bit like I have done with the review of unification, and bring back report people they could trust, people who knew the national interests and would therefore take that into consideration. It was a very good concept, and as you know, it was abolished eventually. It was a company was hired to look at efficiencies and lowering levels of bureaucracy in national defense, and that was one of the things that disappeared. But if you are at all familiar with what happened in Somalia and, you know, the people that were killed by our troops, tortured, and other events like this, this more than ever, this is where we should have been. And as you know, when the commission, when Judge, can't remember the name, was created, it made the headlines and the presentation, and the CDS lost his job over the results and all this. Can't remember his name. This wouldn't have happened if we had been allowed to do our job. But the government didn't want scrutiny. They didn't want scrutiny, so. And that was it. I retired in 19... I was due to retire February 1901, my birthday. And on my birthday, but I had accumulated so much vacation time, 6 months. So I left in July of 1990, came to Ottawa, and came to Victoria, and have been living here ever since, retired. That's it.
Just a few last questions, just to finish off the interview. What do you think your most memorable moment was during the whole time that you had served in either service, but, you know, the one moment that kind of...
They were... You know, I've often asked myself that I was a babe in the woods. I came from a small village, a small city, high school education, came in Victoria, learned to speak English. I took all these things in stride. I did it. And I was happy that I had gone over the obstacles. I never feared a new job, and therefore I never felt exhilarated when I accomplished it. I always expected that my work would be evaluated by the people. I never spent time myself, analyzed myself a lot from my, I have to because of all the change of, I had to put myself through, but I never second-guessed myself. I just felt that the tools that I'd been given the way I had been prepared for the jobs would see me through. So no, I cannot say that, you know, that's the marathon. There were never any moments like, there were little moments, and the promotions were always unexpected, always unexpected. I didn't see that what I was doing seemed to be fitting right in the Army plan. You know, I never saw that. I didn't analyze, I didn't serve at a high enough level. I didn't go to Ottawa until 1984. So this is where the big picture is, you know. So I enjoyed I love to go to work in the morning, right up to Ottawa. Washington was, for a different reason, was a bit of a purgatory. It's because, as the representative of Canada for the armed forces, I knew so well that we were not going to fulfill our obligations. We were not doing. I was mortified. People were turning to me, but I didn't feel that I deserved that kindness. So that's when it was starting to hurt. But before that, I had been so happy, so gung-ho to go to work every morning and to serve with superb people. So I had a lot of good time, but no Olympic medal. No.
What would you say that your most memorable time was during as a pilot, alone, during your flying?
Yeah. Again, I was too cynical. I realized that as a fighter pilot, my contribution would never amount to much. We were not flying the right aircraft. We had the right weapon, but we were not flying the right aircraft. We didn't have the engines that you require to carry out operation when you have to make a landing on an aircraft carrier. If you come back to land, there's all kinds of airfields, airport, anywhere within, you know, small distance where you can. But when you're flying it over the sea, you have to come back to one ship. And so, no, it was not, it was good fun, but it was not, that was not, we were not contributing to the war effort in a substantial way. When I was working with the Army, we were providing the AMOVAC capability that we began to provide and own was a very, and at a level, at a battlefield level of brigade, not Army, not divisional, brigade. We were an effective team. Particularly in Europe, in Germany, the Canadian Brigade there was given one of the most important role of counterattack that for the Alliance. And we would have done that. We would have done it superbly. So professionally, that was rewarding. When I became commander of TENTAG, the helicopter side of my operation was that, so I was still there. But the CF-5 was a training aircraft. It had no radar. It had useless guns. It didn't have missiles. And it was going to operate in Norway, where 6 months of the year you operate in darkness. What do you think we would have done with those aircraft?
Gone down.
They would have stayed on the runway. They couldn't go and battle with the Russians, who have sophisticated fighters. The CF 101, yeah, the CF 100. No, the CF. Oh gosh, the nuclear equipped in Europe had a valid function, maybe not one that you would accept, but the CF-5 was a farce. We were sending a training aircraft and we're telling the Norwegian that we were going to save them. That was the lowest point. You're asking what the highest point was. The lowest point in my career was I was going to Norway once or twice a year to meet with the Norwegians, and I was hurting all over.
Well, one last question. Having served in all three services, which one do you find was your favorite and why?
I have to pick a Navy. When I look back at what they did with me, how they picked me up from a little, I was surrounded, I don't know, 20,000 people, I guess, big shipbuilding center then. But they picked me, a Yahoo, and formed me, shaped me, that I could rise to each occasion effortlessly, always feeling that, my God, you know, this is going to be tough, but not, oh my God, you know. No, I was not overconfident, but I was not lacking confidence. And they did that. The Navy is a superb service. It has to be self-reliant because they are at sea all the time, and there's no, what they have is what they get. And so probably that was the best formation I ever got. It was also from a family man point of view, the worst time I ever had. I was away 6 months out of the year. My wife raised all our kids single-handedly until I joined the Army, you know. Next, the Army. The Army as a soul. The Army is a family. The regiment is a family. And people join a family when they join a regiment. But even the Navy cannot aspire to create that kind of belonging, that kind of, because they go from ship to ship, they go from, you know. But the Army, you are van news today, you will be a van news until you die, or RPC, or, you know. And they taught me so much about living under the a little bit.
I don't know. I just feel like I keep seeing that.
Yeah. So, you know, you live in the field. You camp, you've gone on vacation camping in a tent.
Yeah.
Okay, now, this is not a vacation with the Army. This is a way of life. Mm-hmm. And they're going to make that as comfortable, but as operational as they can. They are not going to sacrifice. They know that if you're frozen to death, or if you haven't had your sleep, or, you know, the conditions, and if the meals are not good and all this, that you are not going to be a good soldier. So they do all those things, and they do it superbly, but under the most atrocious living condition imaginable. And the way they do that, and the care that they take to make sure that they succeed, is a sight to behold. And to be given the opportunity to serve with them, and to reach, you know, the level that they, and to be trained to achieve those same qualities is a privilege. Now, I won't say too much about the Air Force.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for being part of our project here and for agreeing to be interviewed by us.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you very much.
I've enjoyed living there. I'm going to be in a better position to do it now.